Hello and welcome to Astrology Studio for Libra for 2021, 2022. This reading is also valid for Libra rising, and many people with Libra moon like to tune in as well. Thank you for joining me. We're here with some information from your astrology, some thoughts and some ideas to consider. Earlier today, I made a short video looking at the charts I'm using for this reading. Hopefully, that will be more informative than it will be confusing. The two should work together. In those videos, I describe the two different charts that I am working with. One is for the new moon on October 6th, and one is for a triple conjunction of Mercury retrograde, Mars, and the Sun that takes place on Saturday the 9th. They are similar charts. They're really part of the same thing, although I think that in particular the triple conjunction in your birth sign or rising sign of retrograde Mercury, Mars, and the Sun is noteworthy. I did almost the entire, almost all of my information used in the metamorphosis reading came from this one chart for this one aspect. It's so unusual, and as I have suggested in a few different places, this appears to be representative of a before and after moment in your life, and it is fairly rare that those kinds of moments are described by charts that include big events of fast-moving planets. Usually before and after we're talking about things that are very slow movers, but sometimes the inner planets, the personal planets, the quicker-moving planets get together in such a way that suggests something. And I think that what this is about, given that we are talking about the sign Libra, which is one of those very intimate and personal signs that primarily considers the influence of one-on-one relationships, is that there is something going on in terms of intrusion in our relationships, and slowly I've been assembling this. It sometimes can take a lot of time going through a chart to see what's going on, and I think that the first standout thing in this chart is that Mars is in Libra, and Mars is either in detriment or fall in Libra. In other words, Mars rules Aries and also Scorpio. And so when a planet is in the sign opposite the one that it rules, there's something interesting happening there. It happens as often as anything else, but it's still an interesting combination of factors and colors. And the simplest way to put this is that as far as Libra is concerned, Mars is usually experienced as an extrinsic idea. In other words, it's not you, it's someone else. It's not your stuff, it's someone else's stuff. And I'd like to take this first segment and go through some of the possibilities, looking at the signs that, and houses that Libra, well, that Mars rules, and what it would mean to have Mars in Libra as a visitor from those places. The deepest concern about humanity that I have right now is that there are very large forces that are transgressing the personal boundary in a way that is criminal, that is, to my thinking, as something of a hobby constitutional scholar, wrong. And this represents a profound invasion of our privacy and our right to choose. And this retrograde Mercury-Mars-Sun conjunction has been reminding me of this for months now. And I'm finally starting to see what that is about. So let's start with how opposite signs work, which is that in the cosmos of sun sign astrology, the kind done by Linda Goodman, Patrick Walker, Jonathan Kaner, right? All those great people were getting really good readings without the natal chart. In the world of the solar chart, Aries is the relationship angle to Libra. It's the opposite house and sign, and it is ruled by Mars. And so when there is the presence of the ruling planet of the opposite sign, that's a little like the person represented by that is visiting, or if it's not a friendly influence, you might say that it's muscled in, transgressing, showing up unwelcome. And I think that both are possible. Both possibilities exist, though in the context of things, in the context of all of what we are experiencing, in the way of how many people think it's okay to mind your business and to tell you what to do and to tell you why to do it. Because that, by the way, is your only way out of being told what to do when it's not appropriate, is why you would do that. The what is, in a sense, generic. It does not necessarily have a value. You know, it might be off-putting if someone orders you to take your clothes off. But if you have just come through a chemical contamination and your clothes are contaminated and a hazmat worker says, take your clothes off, you just take your clothes off, right? So it's all about the context. It's not about the thing. And it's the context that is interesting here. So we've got a visitor from the opposite sign, the world of the other, showing right up. In a prominent way, it's showing up, first of all, as a presence in Libra. That's about, I don't know, what's the total time on that? I always end up needing one fact that I didn't look up in advance. And there's no, like, compendium of all of this stuff. But let's look at positions. Mars entered Libra September 14th, and it enters Scorpio on October 30th. It's about a six-week trip through Libra. And along the way, it's doing a number of interesting things. Made a conjunction to Logos, made an opposition to Salacia, made an opposition to Chiron. But now, the forthcoming chart for the new moon is Moon, Sun, Mars conjunct. So what is that? Perfectly good new moon in your sign, but there's this interloper. There's this visitor from over in the other country. Now, that could be perfectly pleasant if you want that, but the question is, what's the role of this influence? Then, a couple of days later, there's another conjunction of the sun and Mars, again, that holds through the week, conjunct retrograde Mercury. So the retrograde Mercury gives a clue that there is potentially something in the past that's showing up. That's always the case with retrogrades. Or it holds a clue that there's something from a hidden dimension showing up. Mercury rules Virgo, your 12th house. So you'll get a sense of what that is when you experience, or if you experience, this sensation of something from the past appearing in the present and wanting to have an influence, it wants to take over, it wants to shape your thinking, influence your choices, a lot of possibilities here. But the overall message is to be on the lookout for anything extrinsic to yourself that in any way attempts to influence you. And the challenge here is that the influence may be something that you usually take for granted. The seventh house can function like an invisible environment. And by the way, the 12th can as well. The seventh and the 12th, which are kind of inkblot opposites of one another, can both function as invisible environments. And one is the invisible environment we're walking around in all day, staring at, looking at, and all the people we meet and we talk to and all that. And because it's an invisible environment, we don't usually see it and we don't usually notice the things that come from it. But we do have a visitor, and that visitor is Mars. And so the necessity here is to really pay close attention to what's going on for you, and the role of partners, of detractors, and of just generally people that you encounter. Now, Chiron in Aries in your seventh is saying to do this anyway. And this long-term transit's about now half over. I guess it'll, I don't want to guess again another thing that it's about half over. It began in 2018 and it's approximately a 9-year transit. And so we're about at the midpoint. That's a long-term thing of taking a heightened level of awareness to your environment, into your relationships. And it's a long-term message to do your part to make sure that the healing in your relationships is a matter of significant and serious focus. Because not a lot of people think of their relationships as a venue for healing. For most people, their relationships are part of their invisible environment. They're just part of the normal workaday world in which they live and do not have any purpose above and beyond, in a sense, what is pragmatic. Okay. Mars is also a visitor from the fourth house. That's because Capricorn is on the cusp of your solar fourth or whole sign fourth, and Mars is exalted in Capricorn. So exaltation is another way to say ruler. Now, it's not as in classical astrology considered as powerful of a ruler, but it's still a ruler, it's still a representative. And when we look at what the fourth is, that we learn is about family matters. And it's all, that is to say, ancient family matters. Family matters that go back to previous generations, but also your family of origin, your household of origin. And the fourth represents your state of safety and your state of security. So if you feel safe, chances are that you've got something either harmonious going on in the fourth house or something that you have reckoned with and made peace with. So at the moment in the fourth, there are a lot of intense influences that are pushing you hard and also represent a kind of a bleed through of the past, the ancient distant past, the past from your childhood, the past as it represented your concept of safety, the past of whether it you are realistic about your history or nostalgic about your history, your past about whether you feel like the world is shaking you. So ball that all up as the invisible environment of your family background, put it in the form of Mars, and now you've got this conjunction making at least four, well, Mars making four major events and two major conjunctions in your solar return series of charts. And so now we have another question of who is involved here? Who is trying to influence you? What is the role of these influencers, and do they even belong in your life? And assuming they belong in your life, should they have a role in guiding you what to do? Now, I say this knowing perfectly well what's going on in the world, which is that a lot of people are putting everyone under a lot of pressure to do something that very few people have thought through. And I am suspicious anytime there is coercion or the sense of being compelled or manipulated or pushed or overly persuaded or influenced or what the fuck ever. And we are seeing who has the ability to say, wait a second, this is about me, not about you. This is my body that we're talking about, not yours. And it is, frankly, a bit distressing to see how fast people are giving up their personal autonomy. And this is quite in your face to have the ruler of the fourth and the ruler of the seventh simultaneously in one planet to be so directly involved in your solar return. Now, there is a third house associated with Mars. Mars is the classical ruler of Scorpio. There are most modern astrologers say that that's Pluto, but this is one of those, let's say, astrologically unscientific things. There's certainly a connection between Pluto and Scorpio, but pursuant to the classical rules, which are always worth knowing and experimenting with, Mars is the ruler of Scorpio, and that's good for you because Scorpio, unlike your fourth house, which is mostly about your family, and unlike your seventh house, which is mostly about your relationships, Mars is about your values, not the values of other people imposed upon you. And so that power of Mars, that embodied, energized, determined, persuasive power of Mars can also represent your ability to embody boldly and stand up for what your priorities are. And that is the only answer when many other people and institutions and countries and presidents and bosses and mayors and labor unions and the public itself are all trying to get people to do something. And not only to do it, but to do it again. And then to do it again. And again. Mars gives you the power to stand up for yourself. But you need to take it on as your own volition. So here's an interesting example where one planet, Mars, represents three different houses in the chart. Represents the seventh, Aries, relationships, represents the fourth, Capricorn, family influences, and it represents Scorpio, the second, your personal values. How you handle that is up to you. If you look, you will see the influences coming from all different directions, all three, at least, of those directions. The question is, what do you do in response to the information that you have? Now, there's one last little mysterious factor here, which is retrograde Mercury. Now, in the world of, is this planet working for you or against you? Retrograde Mercury looks to me like it could be very helpful influence in this, helping you remember something, helping you understand something, helping you recall that you already learned this lesson, helping you understand that you are in possession of information on many layers of your being. And in the case of Mercury, that represents two houses in your solar chart. One is the 12th. The 12th is all things concealed and hidden that have fallen between the couch cushions of existence. It is the place of things gone missing. It also, so therefore, when it appears prominently in a chart, it represents something that has gone missing and now may be remanifesting. And that something is likely to be knowledge. It's likely to be an idea of some kind. It's likely to be a memory of what is right for you. The second place that Mercury can have representation from is your ninth house. This too is, in its more evolved state, it represents the deepest level of your connection to existence. The ninth is where we seek information about our relationship to God. The ninth is also about travel, and it's about foreign cultures, education, and libraries. And so the retrograde Mercury, conjunct Mars and the Sun, has a sensation of remember what you know. Remember what you've already figured out. That thing you've already figured out is coming in part from your spiritual path, that's Gemini in the ninth, and it's partly coming from your deep, intuitive sense of self-understanding, that being the 12th house. So you have everything you need here, except the one thing that is ultimately your choice, which is the state of your values and your connection to what is right and true for you, that ultimately cannot really be challenged by anyone else unless you grant them leave to do so. In other words, your power is your power until you give it away. In which case, you've given it away. And it's not your power. And this whole business of claiming your power and all that, standing in it and all that stuff, is a lot of it is just pure lip service. It sounds good. And generally speaking, fails to take in the profound work that needs to be done in casting off the negative influences that would lead you to stay in a state of your power not being your power. And interestingly, that usually manifests through family relationships, the fourth house, and interpersonal relationships, the seventh house. And one of the typical things that people experience is when they stand in their power for the first few times, they feel guilt. They feel they don't have a right to express themselves in some way. And this can be very debilitating. It is difficult for people to assert anything at all about their reality oftentimes. I once took place as a training assistant in a women's empowerment seminar taught by Kasia Urbaniak, a quite famous women's empowerment trainer. And the nature of the exercise was that a man would sit in a chair at the front of the room, and one woman volunteer would come up and say anything about the man to him. Something like, you are wearing a purple necktie. And I sat there for 2 hours, and also there were about four men who would take the hot seat and be told something. And I watched women break into tears, cringe, cower, cry, stammer, and struggle, merely to say to a man, "You are wearing a purple necktie. You are wearing red-framed eyeglasses." We're not talking about asserting things like, you know, you hurt me sometime in the past, you motherfucker. No. You are wearing a brown jacket. And very few things have altered my perception, in particular of women. And remember, this is a safe environment with a trainer and training assistants. It was the third day of the program. So what would it take for you to say something to someone? For example, you are wearing a gray paisley necktie. Or, I don't like the way you treat me. I reckon it would take quite a bit, but it would seem that either that Mars is going to dominate you, it's going to top you, as they say, or you are going to top it. And so the question is, are you going to be a top in your life? In your life, we're not talking about a play scene here, in your actual life, or are you going to be a bottom in your actual life? Because Mars coming in from three different angles, opposite sign, fourth house sign of grounding and family and safety and security, or second house, your priorities, your necessities, your values, your money, your whatever, intent. Let's take a little break, and when we come back, I'd like to look at some of the slow movers and how they're functioning in your chart. And among them, I'd like to cover what's going on in Libra, Logos, in Aries, Salacia, Chiron, Eris, and then what's going on in the fourth, which is quite a few points also. And then in the third segment, I think we should cover Venus retrograde, takes place in December and January, and anything left over. In this section, I'd like to put some of the pins in the map on the major, what I will call angular transits to Libra. By angular, I mean what's on the cardinal cross. So that would be all that's in Capricorn, all that's in Aries, and all that is in Cancer. And let's start with Aries. There are three, let's say, from my viewpoint, major influences going on in Aries. Of course, most astrologers would not even recognize at least one, maybe two of these, but to me, they are, you know, important things. And one is Chiron. I think the standout one. And then there is a relatively new point called Salacia, And you'll see a description of that on the reading page here. Look down under resources. I'm not sure how they're listing it. And then Eris. Eris is, from our standpoint, a permanent influence in Aries. There's very, very few people born with Eris in Pisces who are still on the planet. And there are a few, but Eris made its ingress into Aries around 1927. Therefore, everyone born after that time has Eris in Aries. And it'll be in Aries for about another 25 years or so. So that's Eris and Aries are for a while one and the same thing. And that's relevant to you because to me, the bottom line of what Eris represents in our times is the chaos that has been induced by all of this electrical media. Now, I know you didn't come here today for a media theory lecture. However, we're a bit beyond the theoretical, and the reason this is so immediately relevant to all of us is because the idea of what a person is and the experience of how being a person feels have undergone one of the most radical transformations in all of human history in the past 90 years. And we could go a little bit further back if we want to include the telephone. But what we might say of the 20th century is that it began without electricity, and it ended with everything being electrified. Now, there was obviously some factories had their own power mills and so forth. But in the early 20th century, the telephone enters the picture. And suddenly, people can be in two places at once. And meaning, you call somebody up on the phone and you're here and you're there at the same time. And we have so taken this for granted that it is almost impossible to explain the profound way that this completely rearranged what it means to be a person, what it means to be conscious. And it happens that Eris and Aries begins in the late 1920s, at the time that commercial radio is getting going, and that was the big one. It was radio that turned humanity into tribes. So, yeah, there were tribes at first, but modern society was not a tribal society. And suddenly, everything and everyone kind of went tribal. And what that meant was that the value of the individual was gradually eroded. And it had a few heydays, like maybe in the 1960s, which was itself a fairly tribal time, but at least there was some recognition of the individual. But eroding fast. Be like everybody else. My mom would always joke, if blue jeans were made mandatory, nobody would want to wear them. This was back in the day when every guy and every girl were wearing blue jeans, pretty much all at the same time. All right. So this sort of decentralized concept of what it means to be a self is coming home to roost now in that, you're being told what you're supposed to do for everybody else when nobody knows who the everybody else is. Chiron in Aries is having very much the opposite influence. Chiron in Aries is a kind of an antidote to this pernicious campaign to strip people of their dignity, of their personal reality, of their preferences and their privacy and their right to exist unimpeded by anything or anyone who has no actual urgent, compelling interest. I mean, I think everyone has a right to not have their neighbor making bombs. Okay. But what their neighbor watches on television, whether their neighbor is sick or well, that's the neighbor's business. And so Chiron and Aries can have a few different effects for you. One of them is that it can start to put you into contact with all kinds of interesting people who are in some way mavericks, renegades, loners, and individualists. You may be hyper aware of their presence in the world around you. You may find them to be annoying. You may find them to be inspiring. There are people who like people who are their own person. There are people for whom people who are their own person just drive them completely insane. Regardless, you are being given the opportunity to meet a lot of people who are their own person. And they may be people who set an example for you to be your own person. The other thing Chiron can represent is important teachers. And with Chiron in Aries, it is, in your opposite sign, important to give everyone the benefit of the doubt in terms of whether they are your teacher and what that teaching role might be in your life. So what I'm getting at is that the important teachers don't always come with a PhD, tuition, in a classroom. They're not always a rabbi, but they are no less teachers. And the kind that you may be noticing are the ones who are in some way distinctive. They stand out and apart in some way, and they make their own rules. And they are teachers by example, and they may be teachers of applied theory in some way. But keep your eye out for these people. And it's possible that you won't recognize who they were until many years later. And so therefore, give people the benefit of the doubt and treat them with respect. And when you encounter someone who is a teacher, I would propose the idea is to be a good student, offer what you can, don't be cheap, be generous, and make good use of their knowledge. Take part in their dharma and apply what you're learning in reality. The other kind of person with who can show up with Chiron in the seventh is wounded types. It may be the first thing that people notice when they've got Chiron going through their seventh. And what to do about that? Well, A Course in Miracles gives a suggestion which says that you should help anyone for whom harm will not come of the situation. So, Course in Miracles gives a fairly easy evaluation of when and when not to help. It won't hurt you, and it won't hurt them, and it won't hurt anyone else. If that's the case, you can help. It does get, in certain situations, it gets a little bit dicey with codependencies and, I'm doing this to help you kind of a statement. I think everyone should be cringing at the I'm helping this to do you assertion. because so much of what humans do is fundamentally selfish, but disguised as public benefit in some way. And so, therefore, keep your mind open and make sure that what is claiming who and what is claiming to help you really is doing so. Finally, a benefit of Chiron in the seventh is the ability to deal with really strange alien situations. People who are completely from another zone, another place, another planet, another dimension, and have the ability to be a good translator and potentially a diplomat. All right, Salacia in Aries, second major factor in the seventh house affecting all of your relationships. Salacia is the question of maturity. Salacia herself was a sea nymph, and there was nothing salacious about her. So there seems to be two different word roots. Salacia seems to be salty, that is to say, from she was a sea nymph. And the word salacious seems to be about leaping, what jumps out. Salient is another way to say that. And so there's this double entendre of salaciousness imposed with the planet Salacia. But you'll see in my article that you can't strictly say there's anything salacious about Salacia. So what's really going on? And anyway, in that mysterious way that a few of us astrologers who delineate points do so, my synthesis is, of all of the above, is that Salacia is here to teach us the importance of sexual maturity. This is a concept that, if it's ever abandoned, it practically didn't exist in the first place, and certainly not a very high priority for people. Sex is one of those subjects where everyone thinks they're an expert, but nobody's read a book. So the being informed part is important, and having a concept of what maturity is about, what that would mean to you, and what it would mean to hold yourself and others to a standard of maturity. This is a really big question. And I think there's often an exception made because the entire realm of sexuality in so many people's lives is just such a disgusting mess, riddled with deprivation, disappointment, survivorhood, and all these things. And so I would propose looking for who the mature people are and who the teachers of maturity are. And if you find one, that's special. That's important because there's not that many. All right, let's go down to the fourth house. Fourth house is Capricorn. Capricorn itself is a sign of family. It's a sign of family structure, and it's the overlay of where the, let's say, borrowing a bit from Wilhelm Reich, the authoritarian miniature state known as the family overlaps the government. So you've got this pretty strong. You're very strongly identified with your family. Whether or not they function as such, you look to them or expect them to be a rock of a certain kind, stable place. And yet, the whole realm of the family is such a repository of guilt and shame and pain and unresolved material that there can be a lot of conflict. Now, you've had Pluto going through this house now since 2008, and this has led you by, if anything about astrology is true, this has guided you to be a more mature and independent person. You have sought your autonomy from this family structure, and it has not been easy. And there's been a lot of, let's say, peak events where there have been shakeups, earthquakes. We're all living with the effects of one of those earthquakes that took place on January 12th, 2020. If you want to know how influential Pluto in Capricorn is, when it was joined by Saturn, we experienced a before and after on this planet, in our society, like none other, except maybe the asteroid hitting Mexico 65 million years ago. And unfortunately or fortunately, you are having to make your own safety. You're having to be your own source of security. Now, while this is going on, there are three relatively new, very slow movers that have just entered Capricorn. I've talked about two of them. Maybe I've mentioned a third in previous readings. Pholus, the second centaur. Quasar, a distant point out beyond Pluto, a little bit, about 300-year orbit, excuse me. And then Ixion, a Pluto-like body with approximately 250-year orbit. They are in basically a triple conjunction in very early Capricorn. And what, to me, what they all represent is what's getting passed down the family tree to you, or what's coming up from the roots of the family tree to you, depending on how you look at it. And these can be influences that people find impossible to reckon with. Others will find profound wisdom in having what you might think of as taproot access to knowledge about the human condition and about the history of their family. And this is, you might think of the Quasar-Pholus conjunction ongoing as the intersection between the family going back to your great-grandparents, that's Pholus, and your tribe going back to its origins. So, you know, with Quasar, there's something about, you know, where, since we're part of the diaspora here in the free world, you know, no Irish family started in America. It had to immigrate to get here, or Australia, whatever. So I would say that Quasar can represent either your creation myth or the creation myth of your family back to its modern origins. And this is sensitive territory, and it's a place to really keep your finger on the pulse of your reality. I have little doubt that the agony of families is largely driving the insanity of the times in which we are living. There is so much left unresolved with families. There is just so much pain and unresolved karma that people are dragging around, that it is very easy to have it used against them. And you at least have been through Pluto in Capricorn now, you know, going on 13 years or so. Hard to believe it, but longer than that. 2008 to 2018 is 10 years, and 2018 to 2022, yeah, more than 13 years. So you have an advantage here. You need detachment, you need objectivity, and to really work this, you need to be perfectly sincere about the condition that you and your family and society are all in. Now, those are the two major houses where there is angular activity. The movement of Sun, Mars, and Mercury all through your solar return season, meaning that These planets I've described, Chiron, Eris, Salacia, Quasar, Ixion, Pluto, Pholus, are all taking many transits from the planets in your sign, which is stirring the pot. It's bringing it right up to the surface, right into full awareness for you to do with what you think you can. One more thought involving angular planets and possibly a comment coming back to logos in your sign. Cancer is your solar 10th house or 10th house if you're Libra rising, and there are two points in there. They're both slow-moving hypothetical planets that I cast into almost every chart. Very few astrologers use them. They're part of the Uranian system from the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Anyway, they are Kronos and Hades. And they're in your 10th, and your 10th is where you experience power, including power over others and power over you. So one way or the other, when the 10th house is involved, usually somebody gets topped. And if you have a strong 10th, you do the topping, whether you like it or not. And as is common in the times we're living in, people are being, let's say, put in their place by the influences of government and of family. So long-term visitors here, very long-term visitors, as in decades, are Kronos and Admetos. No, Hades, excuse me. Hades is similar. Admetos is similar. These represent two perceptions of power. One is power of the Almighty and infallible. That is Kronos. Kronos represents the undue influence and authority given to celebrity, especially Kronos in the 10th. The notion that there should be a VIP entrance, because who knows, maybe you'll be one someday. The notion that the president, no matter how many people he may harm or deceive, should have a security detail paid for by us, the cost of billions of dollars, like probably a week. It can also represent your seeking your importance in the world. It is essential to be relevant in some way. It is essential for people to have some sense of standing in their community. Even the town fool has standing of being the town fool. The rabbi is the rabbi. The priest is the priest. The constable is the constable. Everyone's got their place. The question is, what is yours? And do you aspire to that place for purposes that are dharmic, i.e. holding the world together, or adharmic, serving your own ends in some way? That's the question of Kronos in the 10th house. Now, Hades is more complex because Hades in the 10th represents the love-hate relationship that we have with people in power, and it seems that there can be this negative fixation around power of any kind. And the problem with the negative fixation around power of any kind is that it can very much subtract from your ability to wield the influence that you have, small though it may be, in the world. And so, in any event, there is this subtle reckoning going on that I suggest you bring to the overt level and just study power. Study the influence that people have over one another. And when you see yourself being influenced by a celebrity is anyone you don't know whose face you recognize, or anyone you can't pick up the phone and call whose face you recognize. What power do they have over you? What does it mean that Elton John said to do this or that, or Bruce Springsteen said to do this or that, or Carole King said to do this or that? Does it actually matter? So be mindful of that, and you will be one step further toward claiming your values associated with your second house Mars placement, net ruler of your second, conjunct your sun, and conjunct your Mercury. Okay, a few more things here. Third section, I often will catch up on the things I didn't mention. Libra is one of the signs that is the most influenced by what you might call psychosomatic situations. The influence of the mind and the emotions on the body. In almost all cases, when you don't feel well, that is to say, if you think you are sick, feeling under the weather, cold, flu, whatever it might be, the area to check is your emotional reality. With Pisces on the sixth house, which is what Libra has inherently, it is very difficult to ascribe physiological causes to things. Bacteria, viruses, poisons, this kind of thing. Most of the time, it's about the quality of your spirit. Do you feel well? Are you nourished? Are you getting enough water? And with Neptune making a long trip through this region of your chart, now somewhere around two-thirds of the way over, it never seemed like it was going to get out of Aquarius. Now it's two-thirds of the way across Pisces, so it moves a little quicker than we think. It's even more difficult to get clarity on why you feel how you feel. For example, diagnosis. Libra is famous for misdiagnosis. Neptune in the sixth is famous for misdiagnosis. You have Libra in Pisces in the sixth. The concept of diagnosis is radically misunderstood in our times, where we think that one test for one particle can diagnose something that 99% of people wouldn't know they had if they had it. So I would urge you to be very cautious about thinking that you have something, and very cautious thinking that you need any treatment or medicine of any kind whatsoever, except for maybe water, Neptune, Pisces. One of the things that has the ability to influence how you feel rather deeply are the consequences of past events. These may be relational events, they may be things that happened in some way at work, they may be the consequences of past choices you've made in terms of how you take care of your health. That's represented by Nessus. Nessus is the planet of consequences. Nessus, too, is a very slow mover. It's going to be about 20 more years in Pisces in your sixth house. And so this is pretty much you can consider this a permanent placement. And so one of the questions of Nessus is to ask yourself what the influence of the past is on the present. What of what you're experiencing has anything at all to do with consequences of something else? So that's something to keep in mind. And Jupiter is going to enter Pisces in late 2021, and it will be there long enough to make either one or a series of conjunctions to Neptune in Pisces. While I've opened up that subject, let's just check that out. Talking about Jupiter making a conjunction to Neptune. Are we changing signs here? No, Jupiter conjunct Neptune. Hold on, please. I'm thinking on my feet here. Okay, so Jupiter is going to make a conjunction on 4/12/22, and that's it. It's a one-time only event. And then Neptune keeps going. So this is going to exaggerate the whole, essentially, what I would call the psychosomatic effect of Pisces on the 6th. And I would remind you that this is a documented thing, that one single news report of a localized chemical release, meaning it didn't get past one subway station, can send thousands of people to the hospital with physical symptoms. So I would suggest that in being the responsible Libra, that you understand that your thought forms can affect your physical state of health, and that your physical state of health is subject to many misinterpretations and misdiagnoses, and Neptune can represent a spiritual influence, or it can represent a toxic or intoxicating influence. All right, there you go. Moving right along. Oh, and the 6th represents work. So this can all overlay with the workplace. And I'm always urging Libras to make sure that you are harmonious with your workplace. And that includes if you work at home, to make sure that your workplace is beautiful, comfortable, ergonomic, and overall copacetic. All right, Libra influence of major importance. Taurus on the 8th house. You share a common ruler with Taurus in the form of the planet Venus. This is your 8th house. Taurus is your 8th house. There are always other things in the solar chart that further describe the qualities ascribed to the sun sign itself. So, for example, Libra is considered the sign of serious relationships, lasting, bonded partnerships. Libra happens to have Taurus on the 8th house, which essentially says the same thing, that in your committed, consummated, whether financially, sexually, by marriage, by inheritance, or all the above, you want stability. That's Taurus. But now what you've got going on is Uranus moving through your 8th house. That, too, is a long-term transit, 7-year transit, beginning in the spring of 2018. Do the math. It's going to go on for a while. We're about halfway done with Uranus and Taurus also. Is disrupting these patterns. It is challenging you with various different kinds of shakeups in your relationships. It may be leading you to want to be a free person for the first time. It may be leading you to want to be independent for the first time. You may not want to have your interests so tied up in those of other people. You may not be so excited about the imposition of values by the in-laws. You may not want to go duck hunting the third weekend of July of every year till you die, whatever it might be. You may just want to move and shake and be independent. And there is a suggestion that you may not be so interested in maintaining strict monogamy anymore. Now, I'm not saying that you do or that you don't, but what I am saying is that our culture, and most others, tend to vehemently, verging on violently, shove this on people before they have had 5 seconds to think about it. And that would be consistent with Taurus on the eighth house. However, when Uranus is there, this is a major shakeup. This is a revolt, a revolution, a challenge to the status quo. And so if you're feeling restless, and if you're feeling like the status quo is challengeable for the first time, if you're feeling like you want to be independent from all that you were committed to, that is the work of Uranus moving through Taurus. That is the time of humanity in your lifetime where this is a challenge. Now, there's something underneath this, and this is not necessarily about wanting to be, you know, the polyamorous queen whatever. Add your insult to that, normally hurled at people who do not toe the line of this monogamous religion that very few people end up following anyway. But there's an underlying level of your role as a sexual healer, as expressed by 1992 QB1, now called Albion. I'll probably always call it QB1. The first Kuiper object discovered beyond Pluto, about which I've written quite a bit. Used to be at 1992QB1.com. Well worth reading this article on the 25th anniversary of the Kuiper Belt a few years back. I'll make sure that gets on the resources page. If it doesn't, let me know, because I consider it essential to understanding the way in which you are rethinking your concept of what commitment is. Okay, so you have that going on. And let's talk about one other placement, one other house, and that being the fifth house. The fifth is a house that I would say most people are real underachievers when it comes to the fifth house. The reason they're underachievers is because people don't really take too many risks. And if they do, and then they seem to fail once, they're likely to, not want to try it again. And it's very important to be willing to take what I would call reasonable risks. And you have Aquarius on this house, so five signs away from Libra is Aquarius, and that means you have Libra as a fifth house influence. Rather, Aquarius is a fifth house influence. And there are big planets here now. First of all, on December 21st, 2020, there was the conjunction of Jupiter and Saturn, the two biggest planets, made a conjunction in the first degree of Aquarius, opening up a whole new time of your potential as a creative person, as a person willing to take risks, as a person willing to experiment, as a person willing to mature and develop as an artist. Now, normally Saturn in the fifth is considered like the boring, wet blanket. Well, you're not, you know, that's like somebody sees Saturn in the fifth. Well, you're not going to have very much fun, and you're not going to have any children, and all this bullshit. The thing that's different here is that you have Aquarius on the fifth. Saturn is the almighty ruler of Aquarius. Back to the ancient days, Ptolemy, Eudoxus of Cnidos, well before the modern era. And Saturn is the exalted planet of Libra. In my view, the presence of Saturn in your fifth, which is a long-term visitor that's going to be around a little less than another year and a half, you don't really have very long, is about finding your, let's say, identity and workflow both as an artist. And by artist, I don't mean Degas or Rembrandt. I mean as a person who's able to conduct your feelings and your ideas and process your reality through some form of creative outflow. So this is not paint by numbers. It's not making stained glass. It's about the it's about the creative activity where you have to take a risk that in some way challenges you, and the risk is almost always the risk of becoming. The risk of growth. The experience where you feel like all the chips are down and you must be this person who you actually are. Okay. One last thing. Perhaps one of the most important in this whole reading. There's about to be a Venus retrograde. Doesn't happen very often. Venus is retrograde the least of all the planets. About 8% of the total number of days. Somebody used to always write to me and be very angry at me when I would say this, and I know my source on this. It's Neil Mickelson, the first person to program a computer to do astrology. And in fact, Venus is retrograde 8% of the time, Mars about 9.5% of the time, if I'm not mistaken. So these two, Venus and Mars, because they're so close to the Earth, and the Earth is doing so, so close to them in speed, are very rarely retrograde. And Venus stations retrograde on December 19th, and it stations direct on January 22nd, 2022. And by the way, in the course of the time of the Sun in Libra, Venus is changing signs from Scorpio to Sagittarius. That alone is a metaphor worth considering. The emotional versus the expressive, the introverted versus the extroverted, the deep simmering feeling versus the idea moving into Sagittarius. But as we move along and the year draws to a close, Venus will move into Capricorn. That will do that on November 5th. Gee, in 1 month. And so there's going to be a long spell of Venus in Capricorn. In fact, Venus does not leave Capricorn enter Aquarius till March 6th. So we go from November 5th, Venus enters Capricorn, to March 6th. So basically it's November to December, January, and February. 3 months, 90 days of Venus in Capricorn. Here's the thing with Venus in Capricorn. It is earthy. It likes to be grounded. It is potentially sensuous, but it is also given to a kind of a prudish quality. Debbie Kempton Smith made fun of people with Venus in Capricorn by saying that they're the ones who leave their socks on when they have sex. Must have happened to her. And you could say that the antithesis to this is, if you're naked, be all the way naked. Don't be partly naked. Go for it. And understand what it means to be squeamish. What it means to feel like your passion is contained in some kind of a set of rules that you've internalized but might not necessarily be your own. And this is one of the central questions of life. It's certainly one of the central questions of life right now. And in the end, it's all about whose feelings and whose body you are inhabiting. And who makes the rules? Who determines how you feel? Well, ultimately, either you do or you're influenced by things that are outside of your grasp, and possibly in the distant past. And there is no time like the present to show up for your own life, for your own world. Signing off with wishes for a very happy soul return and many more from Kingston, New York at a little before 6 on St. Francis Day.